The Lifestyle Show, presented by Selina McKenzie.
Now, in the past, we were deeply bound to all things green and growing. We once knew the landscape and the plants around us as well as we knew ourselves. But today, our relationship with plants and nature has grown distant. We have lost the sense of plants as being precious. Here to tell us more from her book, Vanishing Landscapes, The Story of Plants and How We Lost Them. Welcome to the show, Bonnie Lander-Johnson.
Hi, Selina. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. So I'm not even sure if I want to know about this. It sounds too sad. What's going on?
Well, part of it is sad, I think, but we have gained lots becoming modern people. But I think it's important for us to remember the way that we used to be before modernity and the changes that brought modernity about. You know, we used to make everything that we needed in and around the household. And over the course of the 16th and 17th centuries, all of that changed through the institutionalization of medicine, clothing, food. We used to be brewers, bakers, midwives, doctors, and women especially were really skilled in all these things in the home. And over the course of just two centuries, a lot of that was taken over by the state and by institutions. And I think many people don't know the story of how that happened. So I'm hoping the book will tell that story for us.
So it's a bit of a history of what happened.
Yeah, it's a history of how modernity arrived. But also I do a lot of traveling in the book, and I go and meet people who are trying to make things again in the home. I travel to Norfolk to meet a woman who's growing saffron in England again. And England used to be the biggest producer of saffron in medieval Europe. Most people have forgotten that it can grow here. I think we think saffron has to grow in really hot climates like Spain and Iran, but actually saffron needs chalky soils, which we have a lot of. But it's having a resurgence, and it's being used for a lot of the same illnesses that it was used for in the medieval period as well.
Yes, yeah, saffron was used a lot in medicines, wasn't it?
Yes, and for illnesses that are now being shown to apply still in clinical trials, it was really useful in all forms of pregnancy and birthing, which is something that women managed in the home. Women also helped people to die. You know, we birthed babies and we helped people to leave as well. And that sort of confident care that women used to have in the household is something that we lost with the rise of modern medicine. And obviously modern medicine has brought us lots of goods too, but I think our kind of everyday confidence in caring in and around the house is something that we've given away.
And I believe you met cloth dyers in the Highlands.
Yeah, that was fabulous. The history of cloth making and cloth dyeing is so rich. You know, various counties in England were known for particular colours. Norfolk was famous for its red. Norwich Market is still called Madder Market, and madder's the plant that makes this wonderful red dye. And everybody used to flock to the centre of Norfolk at certain times of the year to watch the dye makers rinsing the cloth in the river. And at those times of year, the river would run red. And my counties around here in the Fens, we were known for a special kind of green that comes from the reeds. So you could recognise a person and where they were from the not just the colour of their clothes, but the cut of their clothes as well. So there was a real local county identity to cloth making, which I think we've lost. We still have different accents and different stones in our architecture, but we've lost that sense of clothing being a real kind of link to our county and our place.
It's a shame, isn't it, when you think about it?
It is sad. I think there are things that we should ask questions about. You know, I think the world's changing so quickly. In a way, we have an appointment with the past, I think, to understand how we became modern and each of the changes that made that possible. The first corporation, the banking system, urban centres, global trade, each of these things occurred within a very, very short amount of time at the end of the medieval period, so that most of us have forgotten what it was like before then. And yet the change was so recent. I think we kind of remember it. I think a lot of people are yearning for a life much more entangled in the landscape, and that the level of skill that we used to have in working with plants, which have now become sort of ornamental, I suppose. I mean, we still rely on them, don't we? But they become things that are manufactured for us, and we have to leave the home to work in order to buy those things. Whereas once we made it all with our hands, and we were so familiar with the plants and how they grew and how to harvest them and what to do with them, I think that's something we are a bit lonely for.
Yeah, and I think it's a shame that we've lost that connection with nature, because we all know how good it is for us, even just going out for a walk and foraging and looking at nature. You know, it's good for our mental health. It's a shame we've lost a lot of it.
Yeah, I think people find that in gardening and in walking and in foraging, as you say, there's been a resurgence of that. But knowing the way that we once survived, I think it's that question of survival. Now, nature is something that we go to for solace, and it's a space that's often separate from our urban working lives if we live in an urban setting. But once, when we survived on these plants, we had to know them really well. And in fact, this is something that I try and challenge or describe in the book, to try and rediscover the way that we used to perceive nature as mystical, even something that had a life of its own or a soul that we had to enter into and understand in order for ourselves, just not just to live well, but to flourish and to be happy.
Yeah. I understand the cloth dyes in the Highlands. I understand saffron in medicine, but we're not losing our winemakers, are we? I know you met some winemakers in Yorkshire, but we're still, yeah. Are we not treading grapes anymore to make our wine?
No, we are. Well, actually, I did ask these winemakers in Yorkshire if they ever take their shoes off and get their feet in. And they said no, but they do other things that I found surprising. The effort that they have to make to keep that grape harvest safe. There was one particularly late cold frost a couple of years ago, and this family of winemakers had to be out all night lighting fires in the rows between the vines in order to keep the frost away from the grapes. Yeah, they really do live in the landscape. And a lot of the people that I met, I didn't think I'd find this, but a lot of them actually described their relationship with nature very much the way that I have read about it in the archives. They had that kind of medieval connection to the land, and they clearly would never leave it. You know, there was one farmer I spoke to in Ireland in the chapter about wheat, and he said his rediscovery of the soil and the importance of the soil's fertility now means that he sees the soil as his fifth child. He's a father of four, and the soil is his fifth child. And that sense that the land is your family, and that you need it, and it needs you. You know, it calls out to us as well to be worked with. It doesn't necessarily want to be abandoned or left to go completely wild. It does need us to participate in it.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, we've talked about cloth dye, we've now talked about grapes and saffron. I was reading one of the first things to go were apples. We've not lost our apples, have we?
Well, you'd be surprised. England and Ireland are so heavily orcharded. I think all of Europe was very, very heavily orcharded. Certainly, I know in my county, and I think in England as a whole, or the reduction of orchards is staggering. But mostly we don't notice because we're happy to buy the apples grown in Australia or South Africa through the supermarket. But orchards are essential to the biodynamics. You know, they're a big half, bees feed on them a lot, but they're also really important for us. They're an important fruit in our diet, but that we've eaten them for so long, our bodies are kind of familiar with them. But the loss of apples is the first step in the story, because they were always the fruit of commoners. So, you know, medieval people didn't own land, but they could access land and food. And in fact, it was a right enshrined in law that commoners would be able to access orchards and orchard fruit. So when private property first emerged after the dissolution of the monasteries, a lot of orchards became enclosed and separated from commoners. And this had a very grave effect on our ability to feed ourselves. But it also introduced this very modern idea that we could own land and enclose it and take it away from everybody's access, which was a radical and very, very controversial idea, but one that I think we now take as given, that someone will own every plot of land that we pass through. We can't take what we want from it.
Yeah, and it's a shame that there's so much building as well going on the land. I mean, I often think about the squirrels, the birds, where are they going to get their food from if we keep building on the Greenland?
Yeah, fences are something we really cling to, aren't they? But they are kind of unnatural in the sense of the way that the world operates best with humans, plants and animals or part of the same sort of system. And I would, you know, God is in there too. For medieval people, the whole thing had a mystical dimension, which we've kind of lost. And that was always one of the arguments for why commoners needed to be able to access land, because that access was divinely given. And that's something that we've forgotten about, I think.
Yeah.
And that sense of mystery and a soulfulness to our place in the land.
Yeah, I agree. And you mentioned, Bonnie, a chapter on wheat. Is there a different chapter for each subject then?
There is, yeah. I start with apples and I move through saffron. Woad is the plant dyes. Timber, I went to Sussex and stayed in a forest there. Timber was a very crucial element when we used to make everything out of wood. But during a particularly revolutionary period in the 17th century, timber was enclosed by the government at the time for military purposes. But there was a lot of alarm in the 17th century about the loss of, or deforestation, or the loss of access to wood. And then I look at reeds in the Fenlands here, which has a very volatile history. The draining of the fens and the revolt of the Fenlanders in response to that was a really dynamic and very grave moment in our history. Most English fen has now been drained and has been turned over to agricultural growing. And then I go up to Yorkshire to find out about grape growing. Grapes always grew very well in England, actually, even as far north as Scotland. And it's not just a climate change that has altered that. Of course, different kinds of grapes are perfectly happy growing in colder climates. So we did used to make a lot of our own wine. And then I finish in Ireland with wheat, which is something that, of course, we all knew to work with because it was a staple in our diet. But it disappeared through the arrival of the banking system and global trade when we were happy to take wheat imported from elsewhere with quite serious implications for how we access food and how we maintain the health of the soil. But again, in Ireland, there's been this wonderful resurgence recently with farmers who call themselves, they're a network of farmers who farm for nature, and they all get together and learn from each other about how to produce wheat in, you know, a very wet territory, and to do so without chemical fertilizers or insecticides so that the soil health can be maintained. There's really interesting resurgences occurring, and some of those I chart in the book. So it's not all grim. There's a lot of hope.
That's what we like. We like a lot of hope. You don't think it's too late to find our way back then?
I don't think so. And I think one of the things that the book calls us to do is to find the everyday moments in our own lives where we can make change, maybe not in our practice, but in our attitudes to plants and nature, and to become aware of the history of how it happened so that we can understand the role that we played in it, or the history of some of the people that fought against it, and know when we want to resist change.
Excellent. Well, the book is called Vanishing Landscapes, The Story of Plants and How We Lost Them. It's by Bonnie Lander-Johnson, who we're chatting to now. It's out now and we're selling it on our website, tre.radio. Bonnie, I know this isn't your first book. You've written both fiction and non-fiction. So do you have a website as well?
I do, yes, bonnielanderjohnson.com. And the book can be found also on the publisher's website. I'm working on a history now about horsemanship and how we lost our knowledge of horses in the 19th century.
Oh, we must chat about that. I'm a big horse fan. We're not going to make a note, so we'll chat again. Okay. You know when that one's out?
maybe 2026.
Oh, well, okay. I'll put it in my 2026 diary when I get it.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time, Bonnie. Take care.
Bye.
Bye.